So, okay, so here's my collaborators, and I have many that keep struggling with me on this. George Fleming, this is a, anyway, this is the list. Okay, they keep changing. Okay, so now, what's the goal? The goal is, as I intimated, is that since in 50 years, we've conquered doing numerically QCD. I mean, really conquered. I mean, a lot of experimental things cannot be done without the accuracy of lattice QCD. It's in the standard model, and you don't know whether G minus 2 is an interesting thing or a boring thing unless you do QCD, okay? So my goal is to ask, but it has the limitations not only of Euclidean space, but it always is done in flat space, and it's done on a square lattice. And it's done on square lattice because flat space is a pretty good approximation to our world right now. And it also is because you have maximal symmetries in the lattice. Namely, this rotates by 90 degrees and it translates. Therefore, you can go to weak coupling and argue pretty convincingly that there's only a few relevant parameters as you go to the continuum limit and you get the exact answer. This is called the operator product expansion, also invented by Wilson, okay? And you have to know the anomalous dimensions and they can be calculated and so on. So this is the rigorous framework that I would like to lift away from flat space. And the question is, can I do this? And if my colleagues told me I was crazy and I couldn't do it, and I've spent about 5 years proving they were right. But if we can do it, this is the theorist's lab. If we can force it into this kind of format, we can actually do very accurate field theory calculations as they are done in QCD. So that's the goal, big goal, okay? So I want to see if I can do things on spheres and not just or any curve manifold in principle. And of course the reasons are probably well known to people, and that is because conformal field theories are projected onto a sphere by a Weyl transform, and they have an exact solution which you can lift from flat space, so you don't lose anything. From a lattice perspective, this is great because there's no finite volume effect. If you can solve a thing on a sphere, you don't have to worry about any wraparound. So one of the big errors of actual lattice gauge theory is you put it on a torus, which is not the world, okay? But the sphere is the correct world for conformal field theory. Another thing is called radial quantization. This was pointed out by Cardi, that if you can also put it on a cylinder. And then the beauty of this is that the Hamiltonian here becomes a dilatation operator, and you have direct access to anomalous dimensions with fantastic problem. And then finally, the boundaries of ADS are the conformal field theories of this. So if you want to understand how to do a non-perturbative calculation, you should also introduce lattices in anti-de Sitter space. And all those are on our agenda, okay? But of course, if you can't do one problem, you're going to fail. So I'm going to go back to the one problem. And I saw this beautiful quote, which I think everybody should have somewhere on their bulletin board, and that is that progress is made by finding a problem that's so simple and so clear that you can actually get a solution, and then imagining how it might be generalized. So Hilbert is a very interesting guy, and he's also very geometrical in his reasoning. And then when I got, so I had to learn a lot of geometry, okay? And then when I got into this, I was amused to find out the person that is famous for not ever drawing a picture is Dirac. And this is from his notebook, okay? And so secretly, while he wrote down beautiful equations for the Dirac equation, secretly he was scribbling all kinds of diagrams in his notebook, okay? He came to BU and did this. And these are actually, this is a tetrahedron, that's a simplicial complex. Here's triangles, here's projective geometry. Dirac was secretly doing all kinds of diagrams and was doing what we now consider very natural way to describe a lot of physics, okay? So I was really amazed. I mean, he gave a lecture. Unfortunately, the lecture, it was recorded, but they only say, and at this point, he went to the board and drew a picture. So we don't have the pictures. But anyway, so this is going to be a combination of geometry and algebra. Now, following Hilbert's advice, you have to pick a small problem. So the problem is the one that everybody usually starts with, and that's the 2D conformal field theory. And the interesting thing about this is it tests this idea in two different contexts. One is a spin model, where it's the Ising model, and you go to the conformal point and you get the answer. In flat space, it's easy. Fairly easy. And, but it also can be thought of as a continuous field theory with derivatives as 5-4 theory. So we kept going back and forth between these two approaches to try to figure out which was giving us the way forward. The net result is I think now we can do both. Okay? And now, when you do that, you immediately, so you realize that there's a weak coupling region on the critical surface where you can think of this thing as sort of, you know, it's not a Feynman diagram, but it's close to the ultraviolet fixed point, and you can use those kinds of concepts in terms of the lattice spacing. And then there's a strong coupling limit where you don't have any of that luxury. But let's think about the 5-4 theory. And it immediately tells you that you can write down the Lagrangian, but now that you're in curved space, you have to discretize not only the field, you know, put it on dots on a lattice, you must discretize the metric. So it took me a long while to realize how seriously I should take the fact that I need a discrete metric in addition to a discrete field. But usually people don't discuss the metric of a square lattice. It's because it's too trivial. Okay? But here, I cannot ignore the fact that it is a metric problem, and it is, in fact, allowing the metric problem and the field theory to speak the same language. That's the problem, okay? Now, it turns out, classically, it's no problem. Classically, the solution is that you can take any kind of lattice, and I'll always talk two-dimension, but it's always. So this is a lattice, and it's called a simplicial complex. It's any number of triangles, and so its basic element is a triangle. But it's a triangle from the point of view of geometry. It's a triangle with lengths, okay? It's not coupling constants because the geometry is trying to discretize the metric. Okay? I mean, it is in fact coupling constants, the coupling constants that correspond to g mu nu. And then I finally realized as I was wandering around is to go back to the, I'll go forward, okay. Sorry. I realized that my mindset was regular lattices, Wilson lattice gauge theory, I would try to generalize that. I knew that Cardi had said that this was a great thing to do in radial quantization. He also had a warning that he thought it was impossible, or at least not a good thing to try. In fact, the first paper I wrote on this was, I found was refereed by Cardi, and he rejected it. And I sent back a thing, I did found this later, I sent back saying, look, you know, we made some progress, we can't expect to solve this in every single article. And he said, yeah, that's fine. He said, great, and accepted it. He later told me that he thought it was a good start, but it was a very rough start. But then, as I said, I finally realized rather recently that I had to spend more time thinking about the geometry. Now it turns out earlier, in 1961, 13 years before Wilson, Reggie wrote down the exact lattice description of the metric field. Okay? Remarkable thing, okay? And this paper is usually ignored from the point of view of smooth lattices, because they thought, well, it's a starting point for quantum gravity, which it may be, okay? But I'm not doing quantum gravity. I want to do fixed manifolds and quantum matter. Now, I'm not uninterested in the rest. And in fact, if we let the gravity oscillate, you'll get a graviton. I mean, yeah, so I mean, it's a beginning of quantum gravity for sure. And so one way to think about this is to say that And by the way, Reggie's lattice for the Einstein's equations is exactly this simplicial lattice. So the lattice I was beginning to use for the matter is exactly the same lattice as Reggie. And I've been sort of going back and forth and realizing there was a connection. And then finally I realized at least I agreed on what the lattice was. Okay? Now, what is not trivial is the following. Okay, so here's what I just wrote on the board so you can see it better. Okay, so the point is that classically, you can think of Einstein's equations and an energy momentum tensor. And it's important to realize that the Einstein's equations is the response to a differential change in the metric. But the response of the matter field to a differential change in the metric is the energy-Antoine tensor. So at a classical level, if you go discrete, you want to be very careful that you can get Einstein's equations discretely and you can get the energy-Antoine tensor discretely. And if you do that, you've done classical physics, okay? However, in quantum physics, on the right-hand side, there is an exact statement about what the energy-Antoine tensor does to a quantum amplitude. When you vary a quantum amplitude with respect to the metric, it inserts the energy-momentum tensor. It gives you a correlator. And so that, what that means is that the energy-momentum tensor is the thing that changes coordinates differentially, okay? And the energy-momentum tensor plays an amazingly important role in conformal field theory because it's exactly conserved and it's exactly a marginal operator. So whenever you write down something in an unknown geometry, you do not know whether you're writing down the right theory. It may also have a term which is the energy-Antoine tensor. That will not break conformal symmetry. It'll only make it a conformal problem in a metric that you have not yet decided to name. Did everybody get that? That's really that's the bottom line. I know this sounds very abstract, but it's really classic physics, which I had to relearn, okay? Okay, so I'm going to stop with questions at this point. I'll start to do the actual solution, and then you'll see all of the wheels and cogs that have to make this work, okay? But the point is that I'm setting up a lattice, and by the way, Reggie's title, it really hit me in the face when I read it, is that it's called general relativity without coordinates. Why is it without coordinates? Because what he does is he uses I just learned from a person here, the Whitney embedding theorem. The way you set up the geometry, according to Reggie, is you go to a larger space, actually twice the size of the manifold, in which everything's flat. And then when you're in this larger space, so you should imagine that this is some funny shaped curve, okay? And when you're in that space, you have points in that space. This is P1, P2. And you assign lengths. So in other words, it's assigning a geodesic, which is written differentially in terms of a metric. But this depends on coordinates. This depends on coordinates. This doesn't have any coordinates, right? So Reggie is one of the ways to write gravity discretely without coordinates, because the lengths are inherited from the flat space in which it's embedded, okay? Now, of course, it's not perfect, and in his space, that means this is entirely flat. So the manifold is a bunch of flat triangles, or in higher dimension, tetrahedrons, and it gives you a manifold which is continuous, but not differentiable, okay? And what happens is that you can therefore, as a bug, you can crawl very nicely across any edge like this. You don't know. You don't see anything intrinsically, anything. You can keep crawling like this. 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 You keep crawling like this. But if you transport a vector, you discover that the vector comes out in the wrong place. And that means that somewhere inside this circle, some non-flat geometry exists, and Reggie names it entirely. It's not, I'm sure it's not convenient. And it turns out that here it's what's called a deficit angle, and there's a delta function of the curvature. So this thing is a manifold that is flat except for where it's infinite. Okay? And then he generalizes it to higher dimensions. It works the same way. If you go to a tetrahedron, what happens is two tetrahedrons have a common face. You can crawl from one to the other. But if you go around the edge, it then has a curvature. Okay? So the Reggie manifold is everywhere flat except for where it's infinite, okay? Nonetheless, he writes down the action as a function of these links discretely. And you can take the derivative of this action as if it were a metric, And you can get the equation, discrete equations of motion for Einstein's equations, and you can prove that the solutions to those equations are all the possible metrics of general relativity. Okay? It is an exact lattice realization of classical relativity. Okay? And in fact, it's very elegant. It solves Bianchi identities and has all kinds of beautiful symmetries. It's not, you know, it's not just a crazy idea. It's really a fantastically brilliant idea, actually. Okay? And I think one which, it's not that it's been ignored, but I think this important part of it has not been done. And then actually, T.D. Lee and Fehrenberg and Freiberg and Wren started a little bit of the program that I'm doing, and that is saying, but I don't want these delta functions. I want to take a limit where the field theory believes it's in a flat differentiable monofold, right? Kind of inconvenient if the field theory is bumping against all of these delta functions, okay? And so then there is a hard problem which has not been worked on, I think, as much as it could be, and that is, how do you recover a coordinate system once you've given it up? Okay? And the answer is you have to be careful, okay? And the problem is the following. It turns out that any triangulation, classically, will give you the right manifold. You know, it just has to be triangles that get smaller. They can be disordered, they can be crazy, okay? By the way, the same thing is true. So here I have geometry on any triangles, and then I have matter on any triangles. And classically, the matter can also give you all the equations of motion, no matter how crazy the triangles are. That's called the finite element method. Okay? That's the method that's used to solve differential equations classically, and it's used in all of engineering and so on. If you don't care about quantum effects, you can use triangles just to your heart's desire. You have to be not stupid about it. You can't make a triangle that's long and skinny and goes out to the universe. They have to be so-called well-shaped. They have to uniformly go to zero. But then it all works, okay? And the approximation is identical in the sense that here the metric is flat inside the triangle. Here the fields are piecewise linear inside the triangles. And classic to classical, it's fine. It's a settled problem. So the problem is, in quantum mechanics, is that the field theory on this side normally, on a lattice, has a cutoff, or if you like, the 1 over a is pi. Okay, sorry. Oh, I can do this up. Okay, good. So on a standard lattice, you think you have a length, but it's never written down, okay? The lattice action never has a. Everything is dimensionless. What you actually do is you look at some correlation function. So you look at quantum field theory. And from that, you get the concept of a length. And then when you do that, you can translate this into, I guess usually 2 pi over the cutoff. But the trouble is, what is the proper length if you've got triangles like this? And you've got a length here, and another length here, and another length there. The answer is you don't have a proper length. What happens is that different triangles have their own sense of an ultraviolet cutoff. And that is havoc for a quantum field theory, because quantum field theory have loops which measure that cutoff exquisitely. In fact, that's how you get scaling and dimensions, okay? So you've really thrown away the one thing that actually was a tremendous convenience of a regular lattice, by having a universal scheme, namely a cutoff scheme, which was translationally invariant. Now you have a scheme which is jittering around in your face. Okay?
What if you make all those spans to be equal?
Okay, that's good. I'm going to do that. Okay, so here's my simplification. This is a great setup question. So if they're all unequal, it still works classically. If they're completely equal, so I'll do this. So now let's ask how this plays out. Well, I'll do it over here. How this plays out for the IC model. Now, for the IC model, the standard first way to do it is to do it on a square lattice. That's very nice because it's 5-4 theory, because it's translationally invariant. Okay? So you have a Poincaré group which has discrete translations. It translates x by na. By the way, whatever a is, okay? It's just a placeholder, okay? And then it has rotations by 90 degrees. So if you do this and you look at my nice diagram in lambda phi 4 theory, you find that you can take any bare coupling, go to any place on that surface, and magically, because there's only one relevant parameter, namely the mass parameter, along comes conformal field theory. Not only Poincaré invariance gets restored, but the whole conformal group gets restored. Now, that's the standard, one of the standard solutions to the ICMO. Another standard model, which is equally good, is to make it on regular triangular lattices. And so now we're doing simplicial geometry because we got rid of squares for triangles, which are called a simplex. Now, fortunately, these things are not, so both of these work without any trouble. Automatically comes out rotational invariance Poincaré group, and then if you get close to the critical point, it gives you conformal symmetry. If you back away, you get massive states. Everything's perfect. You don't have to do any fine-tuning except for find the critical point. And there's only one parameter to get to the critical point for the Ising model, okay? Now, the interesting thing is everything in between. So the question is a great question. So what if it's neither square or triangular, okay? Now, in fact, the square lattice is self-dual, and you can find the critical point very easily. The triangular lattice is famously not self-dual, but is dual to a hexagonal lattice. And so you can also solve it and show it. But you can solve the general case. So if you take this lattice and you do an affine transformation, which I'll describe, you can turn it into a lattice of any triangles that you want with any edge, with any triplet of edge lengths. Okay? So the affine transformation of a square lattice can take you to a triangular lattice, and it can take you to everything in between. So a general affine lattice is a set of uniform triangles, L1, L2, L3, just translated. So you've kept translation symmetry. That's nice. But you've broken rotational symmetry to weird angles. Okay? This is a soluble problem as well. And it's done by what's called the star triangle relation or Baxter relations and all kinds of geometry, which we all did. So, but the interesting thing is that when you solve this thing, so this was the simple problem we finally realized was worthy of more study. So where do I, what board do I go to? I've got so many possibilities here. What happened to the eraser? I got lost the eraser. Oh, here it is. So what we found is that, forget about curved space, there's an already, oh, look at this. Oh, I could give this talk as well. Looks almost the same. Okay, so if even if you don't worry about curved space, there is a geometrical problem in flat space. And what we basically did is solve the geometrical problem in flat space, which I'll explain. And then we said, if we're very careful about Regi, we can paste these flat space things onto tangent planes. And then we differentiably solve the problem on a sphere. But notice it takes two steps. One is that I had to know that there was a tangent plane, but I also had to contrive Regi to bring me back differentiable coordinates on a sphere. So I had to undo the statement of Regi's paper that it was gravity without coordinates. I have to find the coordinates that the field theory wants, okay? And so the first step was to realize that already in flat space there's a problem, okay? So here's what the flat space problem is. So as I say, any triangle can be tile the plane. And you can keep trying to do it, but they're identical triangles, okay? In other words, they have a translation axis this way, and a translation axis this way, and a translation axis this way, and you have three translations. One is dependent on the other because it's a two-dimensional space, just like on a torus. And so you have this tiled plane. Now, what happens is that you can assign in your brain lengths to this because you're Reggie. But then now you go to an Ising model or 5-4 theory, and you can assign coupling constants. So let me write it down. Here, the thing would be Ki, Si, Sj, where these are the links where I have a single coupling constant on each of the directions. Now, this is plausible that that's the only coupling constants I need, because after all, it's the parameterization of the geometry that I'm trying to reconcile has that same number of parameters, okay? Now, I can write this thing down, this triangle down, action down. So the action on this link for the Ising model is K1, S1, S2, where this is the one site and the two type. If it was a 5-4 theory or scalar field, I would write down this. So I can think of this thing as either discretizing the hop of the Ising span, or it's the transport of a scalar field. Now, the interesting thing is that if I just do this, I can add a mass if I want. But I do lambda equal to 0. This is a free conformal field theory, just Gaussian. Well, since it's free, I don't have to do anything fancy. There's no ultraviolet divergences. And now I can go back to finite elements. And I can say, how would finite elements pick these constants in the Laplacian relative to these lengths? And it actually has a very beautiful thing called a discrete hysteric calculus and Hodgstars and all kinds of beautiful geometry, which, by the way, Reggie shares for his finite elements. And the answer is that this K1, this is the most important question, you need to write this down carefully. The answer is that the free conformal field theory using finite elements knows exactly what the solution is. It says, give me this triangle and give me this triangle, find the circumcenter, which is hard to say, but between the two triangles, the circumcenter is the dual lattice in which the sphere contains this triangle. Take this length here and this length here, which is a star to the dual lattice. And it says that this thing is equal to L star over L1. So all you do is you take every edge, you look at the length. It's probably easier to think of this thing as being, it's probably better to write this way, L1 star L1 over L1 squared. So what's this doing? This is the denominator to turn the finite difference into a Laplacian. And this thing here is the area like this that this edge sort of owns in the lattice, okay? And finite elements tells you that if you do that, in fact, you do it on any triangulated lattice, you always get the right Laplace operator, and you always get a free conformal field theory, okay? Now, the important thing is that we have solved the problem of not putting this on the lattice, but this on the lattice. And the answer is that sinh 2k1 is equal to L1 star over L1. Okay? So the Ising model on this generalized affine lattice requires you to solve the quantum field theory to discover the proper map between coupling constants, is what the field theory knows, and lengths, is what the geometry knows. And I hazard anybody who doesn't think there's a soluble model to come up with why that's the case. Well, maybe we can think about it, but I mean, it's true in the Ising model, okay? So there is an...
So why for Ising model you take sinh?
Because it's a soluble model. We have to solve the problem. Okay. We have to use Baxter's relations, we take it from the triangular lattice to the trivalent lattice, and then we map it into free fermions, and then we take the continuum limit of the free fermions, and we discover what length the free fermions want to propagate in, and then we discover that in order for all of the correlators to be circular, we need to adjust the parameters to get the right answer.
I see. But then let's say for 3D icing, we don't know
the 2D, 2D.
Yeah, but I'm asking then if I'm
okay. So that's the whole purpose of the talk. I don't. I'm taking time, and it's better to do this slowly and not show all my slides. I could. This goes to 12, right? I think the really important takeaway, beside the fact that you can look at my papers and see that I can do math, okay, is that with this problem, I have nailed a necessary condition, that's for sure, and that is that geometry is an emergent property of a quantum field theory on a lattice which has no geometry. I really have to think, it took me so long, and even my collaborators, that I had to say this every day as I walked in. A lattice theory has no geometry. And they say, oh, come on, you know, Richard, you're wrong. Look at this thing, the lattice plates, blah, 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 we put them down, and so on. That's because you've guessed the answer. If you actually have a lattice theory on a complicated graph, first of all, it may have no second order phase transition, and therefore it doesn't have a continuum limit, and you can go home, okay? But if it does have a second order phase transition, you don't know the geometry. But the coupling constants know the geometry. But they know it only because you solve the quantum field theory. Okay? So one of the interesting things, everybody realizes that gravity should have sort of emergent geometry. I'm saying that static classical manifolds have to have a quantum geometry emerging from the matter side of the equation. I'm absolutely sure this is true in this problem. And so what I'd like to do is convince you that it's only because I have analytic control that I can write down these nice equations. But I think they have to exist in general, okay? And that's sort of, so let me first of all give you a few slides of the sort of analytic steps, but they're not, I mean, for people who know Kramer-Warner duality and dual graphs and Baxter relations in their simplest form, which is only what I know, it's all kind of, I don't think it's all been done in the literature, but you know, it's certainly just the polishing of a lot of things that are done. So here's this story. So okay, so let me show you. So here's the big picture, which I think again I want to get this one. Classical Einstein's equations, classical field theory, no problem. You put them on a simplicial lattice in any dimension, triangles in two, tetrahedrons in three, whatever the next simplex is. You solve them. You have no difficulty of consistency. In fact, it's used for numerical relativity. It used to be used, actually. Now there's more sophisticated methods. And it also can even go to Minkowski space, okay? No problem. I have no idea how to quantize gravity. Well, I guess everybody has ideas, but I don't know how it's quantized, right? But, so I'm not gonna quantize gravity. I'm gonna just make a manifold. But I've discovered that quantizing the field on that is also a geometrically tough problem. That was the aha experience. Oh, I have to solve a geometrical tough problem for a quantum field theory, even when I only have quantum matter. And this is now undeniably true for the IC model. So this is a lesson. If it's true of the IC model, I'm sure it's true of all quantum field theories. So the question is, I'll give you a little of flavor how you do this. You do a lot of nice geometry. It's fun stuff. Oh yeah, here's my cartoon. There's a tug of war, okay, between these two geometries. Okay. Now, I already explained this. I said a square lattice is deformed to be a triangular lattice. This is actually a torus. This is a modular plane. We can solve the exact modular forms on a modular torus with this method. So that's a proof that, you know, this even works on a finite geometry. The torus is flat, so it's still flat, right? So here's the steps. You look at a triangular lattice. Now, this is just a graph. I have not put down coupling constants or edges. So it doesn't have any meaning unless I put on edge lengths and it's regi, or I put down coupling constants and it's matter. It's the same graph, but it's two different theories, okay? And then you can show the star triangle relation can take you from the square lattice to the trivalent lattice. Because it goes from to the dual lattice, there's a lot of stuff with that. And then the point is that it turns out that this distortion I set here is an affine transformation. So a guess is, and it turns out to be correct, that you do get a critical theory, but they're not circles. But an affine transformation takes circles to ellipses. And that's the continuum way to talk about an affine stretch. It's a It's a stress energy stretch, okay? The discrete way to take it is to say it takes it to any triangle. It's identical in the sense that these are the three affine parameters, okay? In the case of the continuum view, the three affine parameters are the size of the ellipse and its orientation and its ratio of minor to major thing. That occurs in every dimension perfectly. If I say it's a tetrahedron, all tetrahedrons are affine equivalent to a regular tetrahedron. The number of edges on a tetrahedron, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, that's the size of the affine extension of the Poincaré group. Okay? So simplices are not just sort of cute. They are the direct lattice version of an affine space. And what Reggie has done is made one affine space here and one affine space here, and you got to figure out how to patch it together to get coordinates. A very tough problem, okay? But it's clear that the affine space, at least to me, is the key idea here, okay? And by the way, you see it'll scale correctly, and this shows you that the scaling function, if it's correct, is in fact an ellipse, because there are three affine parameters, okay? There's one important thing. The affine space and the conformal extension of Poincaré group share one generator, which is? This is a quiz. You have a Poincaré group, which is translations and rotations in Euclidean space. And then you have the affine thing, which is a stretching. And you have the conformal extension. Actually, in 2D, they both have three new generators. But they share one. What?
Dilatation.
Yeah, scale. Okay. So they are at the scale. They share the scale. So the scale forms a separate thing that I have to get right, because the scale relates to the lattice cutoff. So there's two steps. One is to try to make sure that the scale, when I go to the sphere, is regular. Okay? And that's a problem of Reggie calculus. Okay? And then I have to make the triangles affine continuous, so I have a differentiable manifold. So that's the whole thing. Now, if you believe me, then we can say, let's all roll up our sleeves and do it on another theory, okay? But okay, that's I do think this is really basically correct. I don't mean to say it's easy, okay? Because so here's just a repeat of the fact. Now, the critical theory in three parameters, this is the critical point. It's this binomial thing of P's. Those are actually the same parameters that come in cluster algorithms, which are the fiercely efficient Monte Carlo calculations that we use. So I think there's something to do it. And this is the statement that the free theory has this form and the affine, and the axiom theory has the other form. Okay, so that's flat space. Here's all of the yada yada of how you do it. You can map it into free fermions. It's an advantage, by the way, to map free fermions. Wolf noted this, to do the map after you get to the hexagonal lattice, because a loop expansion on a hexagonal lattice has no intersections, because every loop has to come out. It has two ways to go out. So the loop expansion for the dual lattice is beautiful, no intersections, no contact terms. And the loop expansion in the fermion form is a free fermion with no contact terms. So if you ever want to do a fermion representation of the IC model, do it on a trivalent lattice, okay? And also, there's an exact map between the constant of the Ising model on the hexagonal lattice and the triangle lattice, and it's exactly the same theory so long as the map obeys cinch 2k1, and then its dual line to L1 is equal to 1. So that's the exact map of an Ising model lifted to disorder variables on the other lattice. Actually, literally, they're disorder variables and not spin variables, so let's get the whole algebra of the conformal field theory. Anyway, so that's it. So now, let me now go to the sphere. Okay, so this shows you that you can do. This is the solution to the modular torus, and we get it, and it agrees with it very accurately. So anyway, okay, so now the step which I've been sort of intimating how to do is we have to take a lattice that's triangulated and project it on the sphere. Now we take the most symmetric starting point we can. We take the icosahedron, because the icosahedron has the maximum number of identical triangles. due to Plato. And then on each Kakasi plane, we can break it up into subtriangles. The problem is it has to be blown up on the sphere. If it didn't have to be blown up on the sphere, there would have been another Platonic solid, which nobody's discovered, okay? So, but when you blow up the spaces, so let me see if I have a picture that shows you this, yeah. Okay, I hope. Yeah, so here's the blow up. I want to tessellate the sphere. So I start with an icosahedron, then I put regular triangles on each of the faces, and then I have to project them onto the flat space of a higher dimensional thing. In this case, the sphere is embedded in three dimensions. But when I do that, all these triangles get messed up a little bit. It's messed up enough that everything goes to pot. So you do not find any critical theory. You do not find symmetries. It's not a minor thing. You look at it with your eyes and you say, it looks pretty darn good. But it's not good enough, okay? It's just wrong, okay? So then what we did, our first step was actually to do this in weak coupling. And we found out that if we took the one loop diagram, ultraviolet divergence, and found its dependence on the lengths and canceled that, we actually got very good answers for 5-4-3. And we did a three-dimensional Ising model, two-dimensional Ising model. We were all very happy. We were getting good answers. We were good to a few percent. You know, this is great. If you if you're in the why not get a solution and write it up vein, which we were in, you'd stop, okay? But I got suspicious that it wasn't right, okay? And it turned out that we realized that it was only true if we kept the coupling in front of the ultraviolet divergences fixed as a renormalized coupling. Whereas a lattice coupling is dimensionless. And if you fix a lattice coupling, it actually corresponds to infinite renormalized coupling. So it broke down. So then what we did is we said, now what we're going to do is we're going to take this affine solution and paste it onto the lattice. Okay. By the way, here's what happened when you didn't add the counter term. You looked at the expectation of phi squared on this thing, and you notice that it notices that it's closer to being critical in some place than other places. And then if you look at the counter term, you discover the counter term has basically got the same form. And so you can add a counter term, which does get rid of this thing to reasonable accuracy, okay?
So make sure I understand.
Yeah.
The formula you wrote in the on the blackboard for the coupling that only works for three theory and then what?
Yeah, so that was right, but that's for three theory.
Correction and that's what. You're
that's doing. Right, and in fact, the problem that we are about to do with a wonderful student that has volunteered from Carnegie Mellon. She just can't seem to resist this problem, which I applaud, but you know. Whether it's good or not, but the situation is the following, and that's what we're in the process of checking. If you look at this diagram here, where I had the bare coupling, and here I had a negative mass to get to the critical surface, and if I write the potential as phi squared minus one squared, and then put coupling constants in front of the kinetic term, right? If lambda goes to zero, it's the free theory, and the coupling constants are L star over L, okay? And then if I go to infinity, this freezes, and it becomes the cinch. And now we are in process of solving the theory numerically at all points, and we discover, it's very funny. People think of this in renormalization group thing as if it were being attracted. It's not, it's a bare parameter. There's a, from a geometrical point of view, there's a theory at each value of the parameter. And it interpolates between finite elements. And we had small enough lambda that we didn't notice we were getting in trouble. Now we take an infinite lambda and notice that we'd be in big trouble. Okay? It's sometimes written as a renormalization group thing, and you talk about the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, but that's not what the calculation's doing. Okay? You have to be very, anyway. So the answer is we decided to go to the infinite lambda limit, you can say that, and we went and did this, and what we found was the following, is that we took this solution, all of this solution, okay, and what we do is we paste each triangle onto the sphere, That gives us an affine distortion of the regular triangle. It's still smooth because the triangles are being affine continuously changed as you go around. So that is a smooth map, but it lacks one crucial ingredient, and it doesn't work. And that crucial ingredient is that if we look at the scalar curvature, we will find that there's deficit angles of delta functions, which are reflecting the distortion of the triangles. And these are not going to become a smooth density. We want to have a smooth, actually find a constant scalar curvature. So then there's a theorem by T.D. Lee. Actually, we discovered this numerically before we realized it was a theorem. So there's a theorem. Oh, I won't do this. Okay. There's a theorem. I'll show you the. Oh, here. No, here it is. Okay. There's a theorem of T.D. Lee's, which is illustrated here, that the deficit angle in the continuum limit. So I look at any triangles. I look at some crazy triangles. And I calculate all the angles there, and I take the angle minus 2 pi, and that's a deficit angle. There's a theorem that says this deficit angle, I'll call this epsilon, over the Delaney area, the area of circumcenters, the polygon that spans that, goes to a constant. Okay? So the, in other words, if you want this delta function to have equal importance per area, that's already guaranteed, but we need a constant cutoff, and the constant cutoff is to make these this Reggi lattice have exactly equal Delaney areas. So now we have a smooth curvature, and then we can take derivatives of it, so we are finally getting to the first need of a coordinate system. Okay? See, if it's a distribution, then the quantum theory is going to notice it, you know? Remember, the quantum theory is noticing every single short distance, right? It's very nasty, okay? So it needs to have a smooth scalar curvature, as the sphere does, right? The sphere has as much curvature for a loop proportional to the area. So we're making the Reggi lattice become a good differentiable manifold with respect to one of its most important invariants, the scalar curvature, okay? And then we do this, and I'll show you the proof that we do this. We do this by, it turns out that fortunately, you make a more uniform cutoff, and you can do it in many ways. You can actually try to make all the triangle areas equal, and it may be sort of plausible, but it's in fact true, that if the triangles areas are equal, in other words, all of these areas are equal, then the Delaney areas are going to become equal. It's not a theorem, but it's true. It's a highly non-linear problem. So here's what we get as we increase as we minimize the square of the areas. In other words, we try to make its RMS as small as possible. We discover that the areas, if we reposition the points so as to satisfy this as a optimization function, then it turns out that the deviation of the areas falls like a squared as we get finer and finer lattice, okay? And then it turns out that once we've done that, we can look at the Delaney areas, and they also fall like 1 over I squared. And if that's true, then this theorem says that all these delta functions are exactly on the same level, okay? They all come along, and that's because we are approaching an affine space, and an affine space has very few parameters, okay? It's a very smooth requirement, okay? So this smooth requirement is actually quite elegant. It's not the one that we first did, but it turns out that if you count the number of degrees of freedom of vectors on the lattice, it's a spin system. Each one has two positions on the sphere. And so there are two times 10 L squared points in our graph. So there are four times 20 L squared degrees of freedom, but there are four too many. So it looks like it's undetermined. But remember that our sphere can rotate without any change, and it can dilate. So it's exactly a one-to-one map, as a matter of fact, to actually minimize the RMS area to get all of the scalar curvatures perfect. So then when we do that, here's the proof of T.D. Lee's theorem. This is the ratio of the deficit angles relative to the Delaney areas, showing that as you go to a continuum, it becomes a constant. This is just checking, well, it's more than, well, it's, yeah, checking his theorem. By the way, this occurs for spheres in any dimensions. It's got nothing to do with two dimensions. See, all of this geometry is actually generalizable. What's not generalizable is the techniques to do it analytically. So, okay, I won't show you. So here's what a sphere looks like after it's done. I mean, it doesn't help you. All spheres look beautiful, but this is a more beautiful sphere than the other ones, okay? You have to analyze it carefully. But this is a sphere in which all the areas are going to exactly equal area. All the deficit angles are becoming equal. All the Delaney areas are becoming equal. And when you do that, it works. So, let me see. Oh, wait a minute. I hope I have it. Oh, I don't even have it. Sorry. Oh, I guess that's... With all of these things, I don't have the right curve. Okay, well, okay. I'll have to show you. This is the breaking of rotational symmetry after you smooth the lattice. And I can show you the graph, but I'll describe it. Okay, so what's happening here is that the first three modes, 0, 1, and 2, are preserved by icosahedral symmetry. We're actually very careful when we do the smoothing to not wreck icosahedral symmetry. Always keep that as a subgroup. It makes a nice test on our things. So this is the breaking. It's noisy. It's Monte Carlo data. You have to calculate correlation functions and see if they're spherically symmetric, right? And then what's happening here is all these higher moments are becoming symmetric as you go down. If I showed you the graph, which I don't have, but it doesn't, I can tell you. If I had not smoothed it, what would happen is all these things here would stay up here and come across here. So without that smoothing, I only have icosahedral symmetry restored. With that smoothing, I restore all YLMs, I believe, okay? So I believe I restore exact spherical symmetry, as does the fuzzy sphere, except for my truncation is a different truncation, okay? And it's also not perfect, okay? I'm not using representations, okay? I'm getting the representations as a continuum thing, okay? So anyway, I'm almost done. So that's what it is. For example, if I want to calculate, you know, on this sphere, the lowest dimension, that's the dimension. You can get things to many decimal places. If I go to radial quantization, I'll get them to equal decimal places. We've done this for many, many things. We can do four-point functions, and we can do, you can do the whole conformal field theory in Monte Carlo, okay? And basically get it all. And so let me see. Yeah, so anyway, back to this. Amazingly enough, logically, my graph is a triangular graph. See, now I want to be able to put it into the software that has been written for QCD. Big problem. For some reason or other, when they put their data structures in, you know the reason, they said they were cubic lattices. But we've got incredible development, 50 years of algorithms and fast codes and GPU and parallelization, hybrid Monte Carlo, multi-grid solvers and so on, all sit on top of this lattice. So all the time I'm thinking, how can I make the lattice at least disruptive of this 50 years of software and algorithmic progress and the development of exascale machines, okay? And the answer is, I got to have a data structure which is logically regular. It doesn't care about the constants, though I just load those constants in. I mean, I do a program, I find out the constants, I add, put down the action. That's not a problem. The problem is that all of these massively parallel machines cooperate across the lattice in a very beautiful dance. Fortunately, my lattice actually has a almost regular structure, logically. This is the structure of the, this is the structure of an icosahedron. It's a bunch of exactly triangular graphs. Now, they're not equal triangles, either metrically or constant-wise. But that is, the data structure doesn't care about it. It just cares how to get to its neighbors. So there's exactly five patches of regular triangular graphs. Triangular graphs are mapped exactly into square graphs with a diagonal. They're very easy to program, okay? And the only thing you have to do is realize that these edges, see, this is the South Pole, it's a common point. So what you do is you write stupidly simple codes for each patch, and then the message passes glues it together, and you now have the topology of the sphere. So I believe that it is not that difficult for me to push this stuff underneath exascale QCD software. Okay? If I can do that, then I have to find a problem worth doing at that scale. Now, the other thing is, what about going up one dimension? Well, it turns out that the icosahedron, this is a wonderful thing. I talked to Hugh Osmond. I'm going to finish in two minutes, if I can have 2 minutes. So the question is, I use the fact that the icosahedron was pretty, and I use the fact that a triangular face can be regularly turned into a triangular grid. And that's what gives me a very nice data structure for the hope of going into large-scale computing. So the question is, that's not good enough if I want to get to a three-dimensional sphere, or I want to get the four-dimensional theory, is I want to have R cross S3. So if I can do that, I can do radial quantization for QCD. I can find out the critical points for beyond the standard model or new Higgses or whatever. There's a whole investigation of looking for strong coupling critical points in gauge theories, okay? But in order to do that, I need to go up one dimension to the sphere, to the free sphere. And it turns out that Aristotle got this wrong. He got a lot of things right, by the way, but he got this wrong. He thought that if you took regular tetrahedrons, that they would pack flat space. But it turns out that regular triangles get flat space if you put six together, right? You put five, and that's the least negative positive curvature you can get. Tetrahedrons, if you try to pack it in flat space, you have to try to put them around an edge and see if they fill in. And it turns out that it's only about 1% off. Was it 1%? Yeah, it's about 2% off. It actually almost folds together to make a flat super cell with five along the edge. Really analogous to what happened. And Aristotle thought that was true, and it took quite a while for people to get good enough at math to realize that it was wrong. It's, you know, amazing how long, you know, geometry has been around for a long time, but doing calculations is not. So it turns out, no, it's got a little bit of a gap, and the Platonic solid analogous to the icosahedron is a 600 cell. If you put 600 of these together, you tessellate exactly a three sphere. It has 4,400 symmetries. And in fact, what it really is it's almost like an icosahedron squared. It's a subgroup of SU2 times a subgroup of SU2, left and right. And you know that the isometries of the three spheres are 0,4. So it's basically the standard way you decompose a Lorentz group. Okay. So now, it then turns out that these icosahedrons can be thought of as a sublattice and a cubic lattice. So again, you can take a cubic lattice, dress it up a little fancy, throw it into a data structure, and start to do a three sphere. Okay. So anyway, so I'll finish with that. So it's grand ambitions, but my hope is that every field theory that can have a flat space solution, I claim will have a trivial affine flat space solution. And then I hope that I can jump to Reggie language and say that I can build the tangent planes to have smooth invariants on it. And then I will have a field theory. What is the problem? The problem is that I took the simplest model. First of all, it's soluble, so I knew the answer was right. That was helpful. But I took a single scalar field, and therefore was a natural map of the connections to the affine transformations. Suppose I tried to do this for gauge theories. It's not impossible. In fact, people have done little bits of this in the QCD literature. You can find tiny little, they don't call it affine, but they're doing this, okay? They do slight distortions, okay? The problem is that I would do this for the gauge potential, and it would then have links that would correspond to the affine space. And then I'd have to go do it for the quarks. But that means the total set of constants is greater than the affine subspace, right? So I have to numerically find out how they track together, because I can't have the gauge fields thinking it's in one geometry and the quarks thinking it's another geometry, okay? And therefore, there is, I think, I think there is a really tremendous example for machine learning here, because the answer is I run the code with these parameters and I test it against the symmetries. And I can get millions of configurations stochastically. I can look at every possible measurement you have, not two-point functions, endpoint functions, anything, clusters, any geometrical object at all. And then I have to move the constants to find this affine subspace, okay? So that's not an easy problem. In fact, this is a problem, if anybody wants to join me, you're welcome, thanks a lot.
All right, okay. Thanks, Richard. A question or two.
We had some during it. You have a question?
So
you were asking very good questions. So let me. Okay, yeah.
So for gauge theory, is you have different couplings, right? That's a problem. That's an issue you mentioned.
Yeah. See. So all of this stuff.
Like, want to simulate some other theories, just scatters with different coupling constants, then there will be no problem.
So okay. So all of this can be done, and it was done, by the way, it's called finite elements, but I really think the elegant papers are a whole series of papers of Norman Crist and T.D. Lee on the classical Lagrangian level. We actually know how to put gauge theories, fermions, and we've repeated all of this in our literature probably a little bit more algebraically, okay? So you can actually do all of this in classical Lagrangians. So I can write down any Lagrangians with any gauge theory, any fermions, any fields, and so on, and I can guarantee that all the classical solutions of the field theory, all the equations of motion, will be exact. So that part has been done. But as I pointed out, by the way, I talked this about only the free theory, but the finite elements will do interacting theories. They're just differential equations. So the differential equations, the equations of motion, can be done in Reggie's language. Exactly, okay? The question is, what happens when you go to the fixed point? And then what we've shown in this example is that you have to change the couplings appropriately. Now, I think the first one is to get the scalar curvature constant. And that, I think, is not terribly hard. Then you are in a critical theory. Now, as you notice, there's a few guesses in what I'm saying. My guess is that once you get a critical theory and you have a smooth map, you actually have the theory you want in a coordinate system you haven't found. You know, imagine I give you the solution to a sphere, okay? But I'm evil, so I pass you all of these correlation functions in a different coordinate system. I have not destroyed the theory. I have just hidden what I mean by the distances. So I think that there's a two-step thing, that you get a critical theory by having smooth curvatures. And then you'll get a critical theory. It's that critical theory that you now have to adapt to get the coordinate system. I know this is, first of all, it's speculative, but it's not a random thought. I mean, I've been thinking about this for a couple of years, and I have at least one example, and we're gonna do other examples. We're gonna do the 5-4 theory, and we're finding this geometry along this line. We're going to do the fuzzy sphere problem as a smooth sphere, where we will have the same thing. We will have three constants in the Hamiltonian and a speed of light. And then we will do an adaptive algorithm, and we will compare it with the fuzzy sphere, which we know is right in the space where it's covers. And if it doesn't work as well as that, we've failed. The hope is that we will not succeed as well, I think, in the very clear separation of primaries by symmetry, because there will always be some order A mixing. But we will have so many degrees of freedom, I think we can go way up. And in the 5-4 theory, we were able to get descendants down to I don't know, 4 or 5 descendants, okay? So, you know, it's going to be complementary. And in fact, I think the exciting thing in this whole field is that we have to look at all of these methods and figure out why they're working and where their strengths are. I mean, we'd love to have exact symmetries. That's clear, you know. But that's not, no local grid can give it to you. Did I answer your question, sort of? Yeah. But the affine group splits into two pieces. The size, which gets you to the critical point, and the shape. And by the way, it's a perfect match because the affine parameters are one-to-one relationship to the energy momentum tensor, right? And when you get to the critical point, you lose 1 degree of freedom because the energy tensor is traceless, right? So before you get to the critical thing, there's a one-to-one map between affine, metric, triangles, and energy momentum tensor. Then you go to the critical point, then you lose 1 degree of freedom from the tensor. It's traceless, and it becomes a mass. So, you know, the geometry is completely elegant, if it's right. Okay.
All right.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, thank you. Yeah. We'll certainly continue discussions after.
Well, you know, invite me back in 2 years, and I'll tell you that I'm wrong. I'll be honest. Or maybe I've taken the next step.
All right. Well, let's thank Richard.
Yeah.